Hey everyone, I'm John Baylor. I'm here with another double feature episode of Stats and Stories. This time the show is doing a deep dive into the world of football analytics. Our first guest is the current Senior Director of Data and Analytics at the National Football League, Mike Lopez. Mike shares terrific insights about some of the ways the NFL and teams in the NFL use data to learn more about the league, team, and player performance and play. Enjoy. American football is a game played with 11 players on offense competing against 11 players on defense, with a sequence of plays executed as one team attempts to outscore the other. But each discrete play reflects actions on the field by players and off the field by coaches. For example, what is the best spot on the field to complete a pass and not get it intercepted? How do quarterbacks differ with respect to their release points? Or how does kicking accuracy vary across place kickers? When are teams more aggressive on fourth down? And how do coaches use their timeouts and challenges? What have been the biggest National Football League, NFL comebacks, in the last decade? And does luck play a role in the success of NFL teams? On our show today, Mike Lopez will help us understand analytics at work in football today. I'm John Baylor. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association, as well as Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. I'm joined in the studio by my colleague, Rosemary Pennington, chair of the Department of Media Journalism and Film. Our guest today is Mike Lopez. Mike currently serves as Senior Director of Data and Analytics at the National Football League. And he's done this since August of 2018, after previously holding the position of director in the same department. Prior to this role, Mike worked at Skidmore College as a lecturer, research associate, and as an assistant professor. Mike, it's a delight to welcome you on the podcast.
John and Rosemary, thank you for having me. Very excited to talk statistics and football.
Oh, there you go. You're starting on the right foot. So I'm curious, how did you get involved in sports analytics and in your current position?
So I grew up wanting to major in math in college. And so I was a football player at Bates College as an undergrad. And I majored in math. And at that point, I liked sports and played football. And I was a math major. But the only data that existed in sports at the time was baseball. So here I am writing a thesis comparing Nomar Garcia-Para and Derek Jeter using pretty naive baseball stats, but it was really the best that was available at the time. And that kind of jump-started somewhat of an interest in this area. But at that point, there really wasn't data in football. And I've always had a little bit of a grudge, you know, now knowing that I could have been doing other things with football data at the time. I was learning the right techniques, right? You're learning multiple regression, you're learning, you know, methods for visualization and things like that. But that data just didn't exist, right? And I probably, in retrospect, could have collected it myself. But at that time, all you really had was baseball data. So once football data became a little bit more public, and there are a lot of folks that sort of enabled that, and I started teaching statistics in college, it was really a good blend for what I was interested in. And kind of would do for fun. You know how you sort of think of questions and it's like, oh, let's go answer them, right? Nobody's asking you to answer them. You don't have a homework assignment in it. You just want to figure out the answer. That's what I would do in football data. And turned out the league office was interested in some of those very same questions. They had an open role in 2018 and it was a good fit for where I am now.
I know we're talking about football today, but I'm a Guardians fan. So I have to ask you about this research on Nomar and Derek Jeter. I love Nomar. What were you looking at and what did you find?
Oh gosh. I mean, I can barely remember what I did yesterday, but like that thesis was, honestly, it was a lesson in bad data visualization. but at the time, you don't know that, right? You're trying to find out, like, a big part of sports data is what's sort of predictable. So in other words, you measure something and you want to know how likely is that same observation to carry forward, whether it's batting average in baseball or run saved on defense or passer rating in the NFL. And at the time, it was mostly sort of splitting your data into two parts, an early sample and a later sample, or first half of the season, second half of the season, and figuring out what's the best predictor of future success. At the time, Nomar graded out sort of a little bit better on a lot of the advanced data. No, he played like one or two more years, and Jeter put together a much longer and probably better career. At the time, I was going to lean Nomar, but in retrospect, I wouldn't trust my graphs, and I wouldn't trust, much about that.
So, as you were talking about the data and getting started here, why do you think football data lagged behind baseball data? Sort of the sabermetrics movement was known long ago. What made football data more available and then this sort of subsequent analysis more common?
That's a great question. I think part of it is all that existed in football was box score data, and you had a really hard time parsing that box score data into discrete events. Whereas you can take a baseball box score and you know exactly what the discrete events are. You know who the pitcher was, and you know who they faced, and you know what the outcome was. You know who fielded it. Football just didn't have that data. Additionally, the amount of context in football is generally a lot larger than it is in baseball. That's not to say that other things don't impact baseball, and the more you learn about baseball, the more you realize you probably didn't know or wish you knew. But in football, you don't know which players are on the field unless you have data that you're getting outside the NFL. And that's kind of nuts that we don't even know which 22 players are on the field at a time. So because of that other context that you're missing, you know who got the ball and you knew how many yards they gained, and that is it. And there's often a lot more that you want to know. I mean, for a while, that information just wasn't out there publicly.
The questions I was asking or in the introduction were all questions that emerged when I was looking through kind of analyses that you had done. And I thought it was really fun to see that there were analyses at different levels. There was analysis at the kind of league level, what's happening, the analysis at a team level, and then analysis at a player level. Am I missing other categories? What are kind of the collection of types of questions that you like to ask about kind of NFL data?
So when you're at the league office, you're in some respects you're working for the 32 teams. So we are principally concerned with the quality of the overall game. We often don't care who the two quarterbacks are, who the defensive players are. We certainly care who they are, but in terms of like our job is equity, and we want to make sure that we have a level playing field. We want to make sure we have an exciting game. We want to make sure it's well officiated, and we want to make sure it's as safe as can be. So those are sort of the confines that we're operating in. And our job is often to ask the question, what makes for the best game? And there's a lot of things that you can change, the sort of levers you can pull and tug. But it might improve officiating, but it comes at the expense of pace of play. Or it might improve competitiveness, but it comes at the expense of health and safety. And those are just total hypothetical. So a lot of what we do is sort of saying, if we do this, what will be the impact on the game? We can use replay and get a lot of our penalty calls correct. That comes at the expense of a really long, dragged-out game that I think would ruin the entertainment for fans. So those are sort of the types of things that we're balancing and trying to answer and help the league with. And a lot of that uses simple box score type data. A lot of it uses more advanced player tracking data. And it all depends on the sort of question that we're asking.
I want to ask about what was a fairly significant change the league made in 2024 when it comes around kickoffs, and how those are handled. And so I wondered if you could sort of talk us through what that change was. And I know that you tracked some data to sort of get a sense of how that might have impacted the way special teams were approaching the kickoff.
Yeah, I mean the kickoff is roughly 6% of NFL plays, and it's maybe 3,000 plays a year, a little bit less than that. And one of the things that we noticed, and this was maybe before my time, but the lots of folks in the league took notice of the injury rate on that play. It has a high element of space and speed, and that is the type of behavior that leads to higher increased rate of injuries. And so trying to reduce the space and speed of that play, but also doing it in a way that kept the play competitive was on the sort of to-do list, and it was sort of a task that lots of folks in and around the league, in and around really other football leagues. The XFL was really the first league to try this form of a kickoff. And so the question was, how do you make the play safer but also keep it competitive? And there is no right kickoff, right? I'm not even sure the one we have now is maybe the perfect kickoff. But you're trying to come up with an entertaining play that, for a while, if you're a fan, we had somewhere around the neighborhood of 70% of our kickoffs were touchbacks in 2023. And why are you going to watch a play if 70% of the time the ball's going into the end zone? And when it does come out, it's usually going to the 25 and that's it. So we wanted a play that would keep fans watching the game, have them excited. The expression that Rich McKay, who's the co-chair of the competition committee, uses is put the foot back in the game, have this be a play. I mean, for a long time in football, we always had this many returns, right? This is common to have a lot of kickoff returns. And so it was really about reducing the space and speed of the play, get it more like a run and a pass in terms of the injury rate, but also offer competitive play.
And when these kind of changes are being proposed, so I like this idea that you're saying that what we do is for the, makes for the best game possible. To make these kind of changes, this has to be negotiated then with the 32 teams. I mean, how does this play out to make something like this? You're doing analysis of rates of injury, you're doing analysis of touchbacks, you're doing analysis of some of the information that you can accrue in the course of observing this. But then ultimately, when this proposal goes forward, what kind of arguments, data-based arguments, are you making to suggest why changes should be made?
So our job is to be objective and to supply the decision makers, who in this case are the clubs. There are 32 teams, there are 32 votes. And our job is to be objective and say, if we do this, this is what we anticipate. And so ultimately, the way the NFL works is that there are no rules changes in season. It is a end of year conversation, assess where the year was and say, here are the things we want to tweak or modify. So back in the off season, would have been 2 years ago now. This is the first year that we started thinking about the dynamic kickoff. It required, at least three quarter votes. Sorry, two thirds votes, three quarters. I spend a lot of time in numbers and I can't figure out what 24 out of 32 is. But it requires 24 yes votes out of 32. So you got to get 24 votes. And a lot of our job isn't to say, go do this or go do that. It's to say, if you do this, this is what we anticipate. If you do that, that's what we anticipate. Now, we could reduce all injuries on kickoffs if we just put the ball at the 25 and got rid of the kickoff altogether. So it's about balancing, what you want in terms of an entertaining play, balancing what you want in terms of health and safety. The other reality is we look at officiating data. We add 1,000 returns in a season, we're going to add a lot of penalties on those returns. So are you okay with calling an extra half a penalty per game or something is what we are now. So that's kind of how we're sort of saying it. If we want this as a result, this is what it would be. And then ultimately, we like to go back and sort of cross-check and say, yep, we were kind of leading the right direction. Or if we were wrong, why were we wrong and what can we do to get better?
I do want to close a loop on this kickoff thing. We changed kickoffs for last season. At the end of the year, I know that you looked at some data. What did that show? What did that change mean on the field? Were there more, returns that actually were running out of the red zone and into the field of play?
Yeah, so the first year we implemented it was 2024, and that was almost a little bit of a trial year. We anticipated maybe around 40 to 50% of kickoffs being returned. We didn't get that high. I think we were somewhere around 33, 34%. But it was higher. But the main thing was to make sure that the health and safety data came back and said, yep, this is kind of what we anticipated. Once that happened, it kind of gave us the go-ahead to say, all right, how do we change the levers of the rules of this kickoff so that we can get more returns? So one of the things we did last year is we moved the touchback from the 30 to the 35. That meant if you kicked it in the end zone, that's a big penalty. That ball's coming out to the 35, not an
Yeah.
actual penalty, but a disincentive, so to speak, for kicking it deep. So now more teams are kicking in the landing zone. Last year, we only had about 1 in 5 kicks landing in the landing zone. This year, we're at 73%. So almost every team is trying to land it in the landing zone. They understand that that's a better strategy as the kickoff team to do it. And then as a result, that's encouraging teams to return the ball.
I'm going to continue closing the loop now because it seems like there's consequences of making these types of changes in the NFL game. How does this move back then towards influencing what's done at the collegiate level or even at high school level and other levels of play? Do you start seeing this type of influence?
So, it's certainly the case that the NFL has, a big influence on what college or high school might think about. But there are differences between the two sports. I wouldn't want to jump to and assume that college could go implement it and have the same exact type of play. College kickers, a lot of them can't reach the end zone. And so as a result, there are some college kickers that probably couldn't even reach the landing zone, depending on what level you go to. So I'm not sure that it would be apples to apples to think that that they would get there. We certainly have had good success with our kickoff, I'm not sure our president totally agrees. He's made some comments about how he hates our kickoff. So maybe that's what's holding college or high school back. But we can control what we can control. And, you know, ultimately we'll want to make our kickoff better too, if there's any levers we can continue to pull.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Mike Lopez about analytics in the NFL. So, Mike, how have football analytics changed with technology, you know, this next-generation stats? What kind of data do you collect in the course of a game?
So for a long time, we were restricted to what I would call box score or play-by-play data. And so you had, if there are 150 plays in an NFL game, your data set had 150 rows. And you could take who was the ball carrier, who made the tackle, but that was about it. Quarterback, receiver, distance of the pass, et cetera. In 2017, all the players and teams got what we'll call next-gen stats data. There was an RFID chip in each of the players' shoulder pads that tracked wherever they went on the field at a rate of 10 frames per second. That gave you their speed, their acceleration, their orientation. Clubs got that on all teams and all games in 2017, and that is what we popularly refer to now as next-gen stats. That is a massive data set. You go from 160 rows to maybe 200, 300,000 rows per game. that's the reality. And so before, your analyst was opening up Excel and looking at play-by-play data. You can't open up 200 or 300,000 rows of data in Excel and manipulate it and clean it and analyze it easily. So now you need folks who can analyze R, or analyze data in R, use Python, which are the two most popular coding languages for statistics and football at this point. In 2018, we opened that data up to all teams and all games. The prior year, you just got it on your own team. And so in 2018, you really started seeing football data take off. It was around that time that a couple companies, primarily PFF, started putting a lot of their stuff out there. PFF was hand collecting scouting data that would tell you maybe if it was a man coverage or zone coverage, if the player was in a 2-point stance or a 3-point stance, and sort of really micro data that could then tag to that play data that you had always been used to, and then also the tracking data. And so now if you take the basic data that you had, you add the scouting data on top of it, which is what the coach has always been using in their brains and tracking internally, and you add in the player tracking data, you suddenly had a lot. You know, it was almost like an open book. Like, what do you go and do with this data? And that's really when I think football data started taking off.
I'm curious, with all the data that's now available, and I'm assuming now teams are building deeper analytics benches in terms of helping to analyze the data that's collected. What type of data can be used during the course of a game? Can an analytics coach influence?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, my hunch is almost all but a few head coaches have an analytics specialist on their headset. That person is a guy or gal who is tasked with some of the questions you mentioned earlier. When to call a timeout, when to throw a challenge flag, when to go forward on fourth down, other maybe game strategy types of decisions that is tough for a head coach to think of in real time. Most of those folks are using data to drive their decision making. But there is no technology that they are using. They are not allowed to have an internet connection. They're not allowed to have a phone. They're not allowed to have a Excel sheet that, you know, the sort of, you can't, there's just not much you can do in real time. What you do have is that you have a notebook that you can bring in. You can flip to the right page in that notebook and say that my algorithm says, all right, it's 4th and 4 at midfield in a tie game at the start of the fourth quarter. Here's what we're going to do on fourth down. I can do that as a team analyst, or I could just use my gut and tell the coach that. But most of the team staffers at this point are bringing some type of binder or cheat sheet or something like that, and that's what they're using. My hunch is that we are going to grow in this space and that there will inevitably be slightly more technology in game. This year, the NFL is trial running. Basically what's a static Excel spreadsheet that opens up that you can use to track participation in the game. And one of the reasons we're doing that is because for years, every single team would have a low-level staffer that was tracking, hey, you know, was Rosemary in on this play? or hey, was John in on this play? And it was like tallying up, like
Oh, man.
literally old school. Knowing that they were doing that, the league said, why don't we just track this for them? We have this data, right? Free them up to do actually interesting and helpful things. So we're giving them some participation data in a spreadsheet now. But that's not something that, you're just not able to sort of fit any real models in that now. There's no AI in game. Maybe football will come around and become a little bit more data savvy in game with strategy. But I do think there's a component of once the game clock starts, the teams have to use their preparation as a guideline, as opposed to, a machine learning recommendation or whatever.
The idea of going for it on fourth down has come up a couple of times, so I want to ask about this. And we've had someone on to talk about this before, but like I grew up watching the Browns and watching football, and I love it. It's my favorite sport. And it feels like, in the 80s and 90s that people were only going for it on fourth down when it was like on the goal line, and you knew if you didn't score, you were going to trap your opponent in the end zone and potentially get a safety and get the ball back, right? And it has felt like coaches are increasingly becoming more aggressive on going for it on fourth down. And I remember watching a couple of games this season where it felt like it wasn't just like a coach going for it when they had like a yard, but like I've seen like coaches that seem to be weighing it when it's like 2 or 3 yards out, which seems like a vast difference. And so I don't know if that is just sort of me catching something interesting at a moment, or if in the data that you all are collecting in NFL, if you are really seeing a notable change in how coaches are approaching that decision on the fourth down, and sort of, yeah, that's my question.
It's been the most transformative change in football over the last 8 or 10 years. And it's, I wouldn't say entirely driven by data, but a big chunk of it is folks that have backgrounds similar to me that are simply pushing and pushing and pushing coaches to be more aggressive. And there's historical research dating to the 1960s and 70s that has suggested that teams could be more aggressive. And here they are. I mean, almost every single year in our end of year season in review for like data and analytics, we will show the competition committee, we have set a new record for fourth down aggressiveness.
Okay.
The next year, we have set a new record for fourth down aggressiveness. Then next year, a new record for fourth down aggressiveness. Every single year, we tick up. And it's really transformed the game. And it's not just the fourth down attempts themselves. It does a couple things. First, it keeps your punters off the field. And we have somewhere around 1,000 less punts in a season than we did versus a decade ago. And
Wow.
that's just a massive change. You're taking a play that brought a specialist onto the field who booted up the air and he had players sprint down and fair catch near the goal line, whatever. Some would call that entertainment. Some would call it, I don't know, maybe just a different play. Now you're keeping your starting quarterback on the field. Right. And now you're having a major, massive, a play with major swing implications in terms of each team's chance of winning the game. As a league, we like that, right? That's a good thing for the game. We have, more game deciding plays that are sort of with our best players on the field. The second thing that it's done is it's changed what third down strategy is. Before on a 3rd and 8, you were probably throwing an 8 yard pass trying to pick up a first down.
Yeah.
Now we see teams on 3rd and 8, they run the ball because they know if they can pick up 4 or 5 yards, they're going to go for it on fourth down. And so it's now, ironically, it's led to fewer incomplete passes because teams don't pass the ball as deep as often. They're just okay with running the ball. And we now have fewer plays per game because we have fewer incomplete passes. So it's kind of been a monstrous shift that had the intended consequences that I think the league would know would happen, which is more fourth downs, very exciting. But fewer punts and a massive number of fewer punts, and then also fewer plays per game, in part because we have teams going for it on fourth down. So it's been pretty exciting to watch. At this point, if you're not going for it, you're pretty far behind in terms of where you are analytically. And that edge that you could have gotten 4 or 5 years ago, that edge is a little bit smaller now.
That's an interesting question. I read a book many years ago called Scorecasting, and one chapter was devoted to a coach. This was at the high school level, who always went for it on fourth down, always went for 2 points, always did an onside kick. So it was the idea of, for this coach, it was a philosophy of possession, which I thought was kind of interesting.
I think that book's over my right shoulder right now.
It's a great book, isn't it? I really like that.
It's one of the reasons I'm in this field is those types of questions I think are really, really fascinating.
You know, the thing that I think it was in part of the data sort of DataFest competition things that you've sponsored, there was some impact of it. And one was the idea that it's influenced maybe player evaluation. That sort of there was like a figure eight kind of drill that was new that was introduced to player evaluation. So I'm curious, how has analytics in football influenced player evaluation and then maybe ultimately player preparation for competition?
So I think football is a lot like every other sport, where for a long time, drills were done, plays were called, decisions were made in large part because that's how it had always been done. I mean, think where players lined up in baseball for a long time, your left fielder, your center fielder, and your right fielder kind of stayed in the same spot. Then you saw data come out and say, hey, listen, we really need to shift those players a lot. You had second baseman lining up where the shortstop used to be and vice versa. In football data, we largely ran drills at the scouting combine, which is where college players go to prepare for the draft and to sort of show how athletic they are. We often had drills that were the same just because those were the drills that were initially done. Players ran the 40-yard dash, even though offensive linemen won't ever really run much more than 10 yards ever in an NFL game. Mm. So for us, one of the things we did at the league office was we took a step back and said, if we were to design drills for the combine from scratch, what are the player movements that they do a lot in the game that we are not measuring at combine? And one of those drills for defensive linemen in particular is that they move in, you know, almost circular patterns. If you think about a defensive end trying to rush the quarterback, they're not usually moving in a straight line. They're almost moving in a curved form. Similarly, teams run a lot of like stunts where players loop around other players, and all the movement that the defensive players were doing in the combine was straight. It was straight and then a 90-degree turn and then a 90-degree turn or 180-degree turn. And in fact, they don't do those movements in the game. So yeah, one of the things that we have helped with over the league is trying to think about, if we were to do newer drills at the combine, what would they be? The hard part is it's hard to take away some of those old drills. You have a lot of coaches that are used to having a 40 time. They're used to having a short shuttle time. But adding some of these as sort of the positional drills that they can do to help evaluate, you know, some of the movements that they're more likely to see in a game.
So you are dealing with, I'm assuming, massive amounts of data. What do you think is a data story that sports media has not got wind of yet that they really should be paying attention to when it comes to the NFL?
Oh, man. So the funny thing is like we deal with massive amounts of data to answer some questions. And then we deal with like the most old school form of data to answer other questions. So, for example, we track every quarterback sneak to identify if somebody behind the quarterback pushed the quarterback. Now, is that the fanciest form of data collection? No. I mean, literally watching a play, putting a one or zero in your Excel sheet is like the most old school form of data collection. But ultimately, it's not in our data. If you look at our play-by-play data, it does not say that, you know, Mike pushed Tom on the quarterback sneak, or in the Eagles' case, Saquon pushed Jalen, right? You have to look and figure that out. We've thought about using player tracking data to figure it out, but ultimately, that doesn't tell you where the limbs are. And so you could have players that are right next to each other but not pushing. So I guess to answer your question, some of the stuff that we're doing is really old school, but answering really interesting questions. So I guess one area that, you know, we spend a lot of time on is thinking through our replay process and what the timing of replay looks like. And every single review, so when the coach throws a challenge flag, or when the AMGC, which is our Art McNally Game Day Center in New York, when New York sees something on the field that a decision in a certain time or in a certain play type that they can stop, the second that happens, we start a stopwatch, and we track from that moment through the end of the decision, all the different parts. How long did it take the league to make the decision? How long did it take the officials on the field to make the change? How long did it take for us to come out of commercial break, if there was a commercial break? How long did it take for the next play clock to start, which is basically the ball back in play? To be honest, how long it takes the coach to talk with the referee. So, like, each of the different elements of the replay process, we are timing, and then we are figuring out, can we be more efficient? Because realistically, if you looked at NFL replay a decade ago, our average replay was 2.5, 3 minutes long. Even a couple of years ago, our average replay review was somewhere around 2 minutes and 20 seconds to 2 minutes and 30 seconds. This past year, our currently our current year, I believe we're averaging 1 minute and 22. So we
Wow.
have shaved off about 1 minute per review, and Mike Lopez and our group is we're useless at the actual process, and there's a lot of other reasons we've gotten better. Technology has gotten better in that room. But a big part of having, a more efficient replay process is just having targets, right? Knowing where you were, knowing that you can be better. And if there's a tough decision, we're gonna, the room's gonna take the amount of time to make the correct decision. But once you have what we'll call it the kill shot, right? That means we see the decision, we know what, should the pass be ruled incomplete? Did the player reach the line again? Once we have that, right, we're done, right? How do we get this done? How do we keep the game moving? Because ultimately, we're an entertainment product, and if we're spending 3 or 4 minutes to make a decision, some of which, if you look at film 10, 15 years ago, the fan at home knew the decision, right? Why are we continuing to wait? I don't want to pick on college football, but every time I watch a college football, I basically go to commercial break, and you can go cook a souffle during the time they take to review something. So, that's what we're trying to be more efficient in. And you mentioned all this data that we could be using. We're using stopwatch, so
That's great.
it kind of varies.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Mike, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, of course. Happy to chat and a lot of fun.
Wow, thank you, Mike, for all the wonderful insights about how the league and teams are using data to track what happens in the NFL. Next up, we have Professor Ryan Elmore and grad student Ariana Gonzalez Sanchez to talk about their paper in Significance Magazine about when to ice a kicker, and more importantly, does it work? Enjoy. It's late in the game and your team is leading by less than 3 points and your opponent is driving down the field. A field goal will win the game. An attempt to kick this field goal likely will be the last play of the game. Do you call timeout in hopes that this will unsettle your opponent's place kicker? The folklore in American football is that calling a timeout as the kicker is about to attempt the field goal will increase the chances that the kicker will miss. Is this true or a fiction that might be debunked? A 2024 article in Beyond the Box Score column of Chance Magazine, titled "Does Icing the Field Goal Kicker Work in the NFL?" by Adriana Gonzalez Sanchez, Sierra Martinez, Ron Yurko, and Ryan Elmore, attempts to answer this question. And we're happy to have a couple of the authors on the show today. I'm John Baylor. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association, as well as Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. I'm joined in the studio by my colleague, Rosemary Pennington, Chair of the Department of Media Journalism and Film. Our guests today are Adriana Gonzalez Sanchez and Dr. Ryan Elmore. Gonzalez Sanchez is pursuing a PhD in business analytics from the University of Cincinnati with a research focus on discrete data analysis and statistical methodology. Elmore is an associate professor in the Department of Business Information and Analytics at the University of Denver's Daniel College of Business. His research interests include statistics in sports, nonparametric statistical methods, and energy-efficient high-performance computing. He currently serves as an associate editor for the Journal of Quantitative Analysis in Sports. Also, I've known Ryan since the late 90s when he was working on a master's degree in statistics at Miami. Adriana and Ryan, it is a delight to welcome you on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So just to start, what inspired you to begin this investigation of whether icing the kicker works?
Going back a few years, I wrote a paper related to calling timeouts in the NBA. So we were looking at Does calling a timeout if the other team or a team is on a run, is that going to affect basketball? So after that paper was published, I was talking to Ron Yerko, who runs the Carnegie Mellon Sports Analytics Camp. And I told him, I said, I think I have a problem that would be really good for some students who are going into that camp. And Ron thought it would be great as well. So he asked me to present it to the students who were a part of the camp. And Adriana was excited about it, I guess. So Adriana, you can come in and talk about like where you picked it up.
Yeah, so basically, I was in the Carnegie Mellon summer camp, and we had to pick like a topic for our final project, and we had different proposals from different professors, and I was potentially thinking about going into a PhD, and I was really into research and getting to know how it was done, and after talking to Ron, like he told me that these paper was a really good start because it was an interesting topic as well as something that can be published in the near future. Those were my two main ideas or points of why, reasons why I picked the project.
So I grew up as a Cleveland Browns fan, which comes with its own set of like ups and downs. And one of them includes kickers. So like, Phil Dawson was this incredible kicker for the team at a time when the team was not so hot. But then in my childhood, there was a kicker, Matt Barr, who very magnificently missed a couple of really important field goals. That's not the word I was looking for, but it's the one that sort of stuck. And as I was reading through this, it sort of made me have all these flashbacks. I wonder, what is it about icing that you found so interesting? And how did you actually go about figuring out, is it worth using that timeout to ice a kicker?
Okay, well, first, apologies for being a Browns fan. I grew up just across the river from Cincinnati in Kentucky, so I've always been a Bengals fan. So I can't really, I mean, they're basically the same, Bengals or Browns are both pretty terrible historically. But as far as your question, going back to the paper that I did a few years prior with respect to timeouts in the NBA, I wanted to look at problems that where you were evaluating a coaching decision, not necessarily team performance or player performance. It was like the coaches have a decision to make. Can we evaluate whether that decision actually affected the outcome of a game? And icing the kicker, I'm to be totally honest, I'm not a huge football fan, but I knew that this action in a game was, completely dependent upon the coach calling the timeout. And then there's a noticeable outcome, or there is an outcome right after that decision that we can measure and say, like, is this affecting, the outcome, which would be the made or the missed field goal. And so I just thought it was I liked the idea of evaluating a coach.
So can you talk a little bit about the kind of data that you would use to start to investigate this question?
Sure.
Yeah, so we use the NFL Fast R package. It's available in R. You just have to download the R package and just install it. But it's basically like a package that cleans the data posted on the NFL API and makes it readily usable for any analysis. And it contains play-by-play data from the NFL games.
So I wonder, as you were combing through this data, I know I saw that icing tends to happen on longer field goals, right? So if it's like a chip shot, a coach isn't going to waste a timeout to ice a kicker on what's an obvious make for the most part, right? Given what we know, how do you, when you are looking at this data, right? If we're talking about like a field goal that's like 60 yards, how do you puzzle out whether it is the distance that led to the missed field goal or it's the choice to ice the kicker? Because that is for me, the big question in all of this is it's really interesting, but how do you disentangle distance from that choice?
Well, so I mean, first, like icing the kicker really didn't have much of an impact on the outcome. So, it's mainly a function of distance, some of the conditions that are that are present in the game, you know, turf, grass, dome, etc. So we were, you know, essentially, like from a statistical perspective, it's a relatively straightforward process. I mean, you're including a variable in there for, you know, did the coach ice the kicker or not? And then you have all these other control variables that you're looking at as well. And so the statistical problem, I would say, could go back to, you know, one of the classes that I had with John so long ago. Like we could do this in a straightforward way. The reason why we didn't do it then and we're doing it now is, as Adriana was mentioning, we have the data that are available. So we have data on every kick, conditions associated with every kick, attributes associated with those, you know, the field conditions, like I was saying a second ago. So really, like the NFL making these data available is what enabled this problem to be solved.
So can you help us understand, how did you extract a data, you know, the kicks that were icing or potentially iced kicks? I mean, so you have these play-by-play data set that you can extract here, and it's some, you had to select from it all field goal attempts, and then from that you had to do something to try to identify if it was potentially had the potential to be iced. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Do
Yeah,
you want to take
so
that, Adrian?
yeah, I think that we had like a column of kicks, and then I think that whenever there was a timeout called the 5 seconds prior to kicking, that's what we considered an iced kick. I did this a couple years ago, so it might not be 5 seconds, but that's how I extracted the kicks that were iced, whether against the ones that were not.
So yeah, and to the other question is like, what are the potential kicks that could have been iced? Essentially, we used a, you know, a matching tool in R, which again, you just like look at whatever covariates that you want to match on. It could be something like, you know, time in the game, relative strength of the opponents. I can't remember exactly all the covariates that we used for our matching. But essentially, you look at instances within the game where a kick happened, and then you try to see like all of those instances where they weren't iced. Those are going to be your pool of potential controls. And then within that potential control batch, you're trying to match conditions that are similar to our actual iced kicks.
Yeah, I
So
remember that the variable that we matched on was win probability. We tried matching on others, but the results were pretty much the same at the end.
you know, one variable that I found myself thinking about as I was reading through your paper was the experience of the kicker, you know, and I was thinking, you know, if it's someone who has just joined the league versus someone who is a little more seasoned. And by the way, Rosemary, I'm sorry that this brought up these difficult sort of post-traumatic PTSD responses to kicks in football. But you know, the experience of the kicker seemed like one, or if the, you know, did the kicker miss the last kick they took? I'm just sort of wondering if, you know, there seems like there's just so many, you know, ways that you think you're trying to get in the head of the kicker before they do it. So what's, you know, I'm wondering if some of these other factors, did you consider them, or was it just sort of not direct to try to implement that?
Yeah, so we looked at a bunch of different aspects like player experience or the weather or the type of turf, whether the stadium was had a roof or not, because all of that can affect whether the kicker makes the field goal or not. But keep in mind that the data that we use is from 1999 until 2021. So the quality of the data, it's not the same back then that it is now. So it was kind of difficult to get good estimates of these aspects from back then. So maybe we had useful data starting from 2010, 2008. So it would have been kind of hard to just base our analysis on half our data or our years in the data.
Yeah, I think to your point about kicker experience, this Adriana and I were thinking about like potential questions and, you know, offline here, and one of the questions was related to like could we do something similar in college football, and I think kicker experience would probably have a bigger effect, if I had to guess, in the college game, just because they're less experienced. I mean, when you get to the pros, you're talking about the 30 best kickers in the world, and they're really good at what they do. So I feel like if you're in the first year, or if you're, a seasoned veteran, it probably you're a really, really good kicker. So the coach calling a timeout, it's like, all right, here we go again.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Adriana Gonzalez Sanchez and Ryan Elmore about icing the kicker. One of the things that you mentioned in your paper is that this isn't just a random decision that a coach makes. That, this is sort of like they're parallel universes that branch off from this point in time. There's one universe where this timeout was called, and another one where it isn't. So can you talk a little bit about what that means in terms of an analysis that you would do, or some of the challenges that you faced?
Sure. Well, I think in the perfect world, as you say, like it would be great if they had you or me or Adriana sitting behind the bench and flipping a coin to see if the coach is going to call the timeout or not. But the coaches aren't going to allow us to do that. So in this situation, we try to do as best we can. And this actually, I mean, I don't want to go off on the monologue here, but like I was listening to a recent Stats and Stories podcast where you had Greg Matthews on, and he and I are good friends. We were I was just listening to his talk at JSM, and he was saying like one of the things that he tries to do if he is taking on a new problem is to imagine, if I had the perfect set of data to answer a particular question, what would I do? And unfortunately, we don't have that, we don't have that randomized controlled trial here where we're randomizing kicks into like we're going to ice or we're not. So what do we do? Well, we try to find kicks that were similar to the iced kicks that weren't iced. And we, as I was saying before, we match on those attributes, and we try to see, is there a difference using that causal inference methodology? So we try to essentially create a pooled sample where we have like kicks, some are iced, some aren't, and we analyze it from that point. So it's like we're trying to recreate that randomized controlled trial that we don't have access to.
Earlier, Adriana said that you also used win probability to assist with the matching. Could you talk through like how you guys conceptualized win probability and how it factored into this?
Yeah, so basically we think of win probability as it's a one number value that is estimating how likely the possession team is to win the game at the start of the play, accounting for situational context such as the field position or time remaining, score differential, and more. And usually we found out that ice kicks tend to involve plays with a higher win probability for the kicker team.
Yeah. And one thing with respect to win probability, that's not something that we computed ourselves. That's coming from the data set that Adriana was discussing earlier, the NFL FastR data set.
Yeah, apparently the NFL FastR created that for us because the NFL API doesn't have it, but this art package extracts the information from there and calculates this for us so we don't have to do it manually.
As part of the analysis that you did, you were modeling the a log odds, and you were modeling it as a function of kind of distance of the kick and of whether or not there was ice. Tried to ice the kicker. I sort of as sort of a side comment is, did you do any interactions between them? I mean, you did it as sort of additive components of each of those, and I'm just wondering if you also played with some other ways this might play out.
Go ahead.
I think we did. I think we tried an interaction, if I'm not wrong, but the results were pretty much the same. Like we tried different aspects of the game as well, but the results were pretty similar to what we have right now.
Yeah. In the end, we kept things pretty simple, particularly for like the general stat, or sorry, chance audience. I think kind of appreciated something direct and to the point.
Timeouts in any sport are precious, right? And you only get three of them in football. And I wonder now that you've done this research, if you were advising an NFL coach about whether it's worth holding on to a timeout to ice somebody, is it worth holding on to that timeout or should they use it in a different way?
So I would say don't hold on to it to ice them because it's not really going to have much of an effect at the end. So you should probably call timeouts when you have there are two answers to this question. First, no, I wouldn't hold on to the timeout in the hopes that I can ice a kicker later on in the game. I would use them as needed throughout the game. However, I would say at the end of the game, if you have the timeout, there's no reason to, it doesn't carry over into the next game. So there's no reason to hang on to it. So just use it, even though the research that Adriana and, the rest of us did would suggest that it's not going to affect anything. What's it going to hurt, really?
So you agree, Adriana?
Yeah, I agree with what Ryan said. Usually if you have one spare one, use it, but don't save it just because you think it's really gonna work, because it might not.
Ryan, you were talking about the idea of kind of imagining the perfect data set if you were going to do this, if you could do this in a, you were talking about a controlled clinical trial kind of thing. But I was also just thinking about, in the same way, about when is the best time to use timeouts? And it seems that, the best time to use timeout would be the times that lead to the greatest change in your chance, the probability of winning a game. And so I'm trying, it seems like that's kind of a connection between some of the earlier work that you were describing in this. Do you have thoughts on that in the context of football games or other sports?
That's the exact problem that we worked on prior to working on this problem. So, like, we looked at runs in the NBA. So, like, if a team's on a run and the coach calls a timeout, does that actually affect? We weren't measuring win probability after, like, for that particular problem. We were looking at what's the scoring margin, like the differential in scoring margin in the 2 minutes post event. But it's a similar problem to work on. As far as other sports or other times in an NFL game, I think this is a well-studied area, but going for it on fourth downs, I could imagine, like, if the offensive coach in this case really wants to set his team up, maybe they're driving down the field, but they get to a fourth down. If they were to score a touchdown, how would that change the win probability? And, like, is it better to call a timeout there so that you could affect the win probability? I think that could be something that would be interesting to look at. But as I said before, I don't watch enough football to be, too into when coaches should make decisions. I'm more of an NBA fan or a basketball fan, and this was the easy transition to football. So that's why we studied this particular problem.
Yeah, same. I'm from Spain, so I had no idea about the rules of football before starting the project. So don't ask me about plays, because I'm not gonna be good at answering the
Well,
questions.
it's American football, Adriana. You know a lot about football, just a different football.
And I was thinking about that in terms of icing the kicker. I think in world football, PKs is a classic example where a goalie will do all they can to try to disrupt a player's flow. They'll walk out, pick up a ball, set the ball down, wave to their parents in the stands. There's a lot of ways to try to break a rhythm for a player. Can you think of other? I think it's a really interesting topic, the idea of breaking flow in a game to try to change a trajectory for a win probability.
I mean, I can give an example of tennis. I played tennis in college, so I'm familiar with the game. But basically, when I might have lost a set really easily, 6-1, 6-2, I might just go on a restroom break between sets just to reset my mind and maybe break a little bit the rhythm of my opponent. Or maybe like in more professional tennis, maybe like when you're tied on the third set or something like that, you might get into a small argument with the ref or something like that, maybe to throw off your opponent and maybe break the rhythm a little bit as well. And in college tennis, this is done all the time, but maybe like after a first set, the ball lands on your court. It doesn't really bother you, but you just walk and move it as slow as you can to give the opponent a break, or maybe like feel the pressure more, and you have the hopes that they'll miss the second set. It might not work, but we still do it anyways.
Okay, so go ahead, Ryan, please.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, any of those instances in whatever sport you're interested in where there's like some element of gamesmanship, you could kind of study that. So I was thinking about baseball, for example, when the, a pitching coach might go out to the pitcher and just kind of reset things and see what's going on with their pitcher. You could study like, well, how does that affect the next X number of pitches or the rest of the inning or, whatever might be going on. So like gamesmanship, I think going back to your question about flow and interrupting flow, I think is sort of the point of gamesmanship.
So what's next for you? I mean, you've done this problem, you've worked on it, you kind of concluded there wasn't a really much of a fit an effect at all in this case. What's the next problem that you're interested in investigating in sport?
Right now, I'm doing my PhD, so I don't really have all the time in the world to focus on sports problems. I would love to. Hopefully, once I get a job, I can do that. But right now, the clock is ticking, and I really have to focus on my dissertation. So there's not really like a future problem for me right now, but I would be excited to have one in the future.
Well, once Adriana finishes, we'll think of some more problems for her to work on. But for me, there's a soccer problem that I want to look at, and that's basically just like player position. There's some companies that are making positional data available on for players on the pitch. So I want to look at like how interactions of players affect outcomes, and that's kind of a tough problem just because when you think of like good outcomes in soccer, everybody thinks of goals, and there are very few in soccer. So we want to think about like, well, not necessarily looking at that outcome. Like, what are some other outcomes in the soccer match could we look at to evaluate, are these players doing what they should be doing? Maybe it's like to increase a win probability or something, I'm not sure, but like that's sort of in the back of my mind at this point.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Adriana and Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan and Ariana, for joining the show. Well, we're long past the 2-minute warning, and it's time to leave the stadium and head home. Thank you for joining us for this special double feature football episode of Stats and Stories. Stick around, and we'll be back on Wednesday, December 24th, with a feel-good episode for the holidays. Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places you can find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on our program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. Be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.